Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to explore a University of Wisconsin study that shows that a particular dried fruit can really help your digestion and the good bacteria in your intestine. And also from Rice University, they're talking about how disaster, any disaster, makes people with depression less healthy. Well, let's do the math. Over 40% of all Americans are considered depressed. And we have disasters. Well, in the last 12 months, we've had over 12,000. So that's going to make an awful lot of people a lot less healthy. Also, Shanghai Institute for Biological Sciences shows that there's a fungus used in traditional Chinese medicine that's really good at fighting cancer. We'll share that with you. And University of Utah published in Cell Metabolism, carnitine, which is a nutrient, can improve your tolerance to cold and make you healthier. And a lot more on health and healing. Then a special commentary, one of my own and also Chris Hedges from Truthdig, our ever-deadlier police force. Now, every day, I always have to measure, and I believe we all should, when we see an episode that clearly transgresses every boundary of appropriate behavior, where there's excessive force, where there is no provocation, and yet there's an over-response by a police officer. And then we look and say, the police, as if this represents all police. It doesn't. And yet, what does it say when the rest of the police, who have not committed a crime against people and who are trying to do the best they can, what are they doing about the colleagues that they're fully aware of who are not capable of being a real serving member of the community there to protect? Do they speak out? We rarely hear that. So we'll discuss that. Also today, part three of an ongoing series on what is happening with the field of molecular biology? What do they have in plan for us, we the people? I've been fortunate to have people that I've counseled from all walks of life, but one small group who are extremely powerful and wealthy. And when they're sitting across from you and they're talking about their issues, they frequently want to also share about the larger picture of their life. They're frequently confused. Sometimes they feel guilty of how they've used their power or money. But there's one thing that they're talking about now, and that is those who have achieved a position of power now believe that they have the right, even the duty, to meet with other rich and powerful people, like at Davos, and to then discuss the future for all humanity. Let's say you made your money in computers, or you made your money trading in bullion or other commodities like gold or silver or oil, or you owned a supermarket chain, or you know head of Amazon. What gives you the unique insight, the expertise, the scholarship, the skills, and the intuition to be able to say, because I'm successful, my thoughts should dominate? And I believe that we should have smarter children, children that are obedient, children that are taller, that have better vision, that are never going to get sick, that'll be stronger. If they're competitive, they're always going to win because they'll have skill, strength, endurance, and stamina that others will not have. I want them to be able to succeed in being perfect parents, perfect in business. And that's what we need. I want them not to be able to go out and commit a crime that we would all say is egregious. Okay, let's say they put together the perfect person. Now, they actually have the power to fund science that will create the genes that can help express part of that desire. But there's more to creating the perfect person than manipulating their genes. We've already created, long ago, under Edward Bernays, the father of propaganda, the perfect citizen. Was it not Thoreau who challenged the idea of being both a good citizen and a good person? And he opted to be a good person because he also knew what happens when you become a part of the consensus, the mob, the lemmings, the sheep. And that's something that doesn't come through genetic manipulation, that comes through enculturation, propagandizing, conditioning. Now think of it this way. Who started this whole movement? It was started back in the 1850s, and then it evolved. It's taken many forms. But at its height, it was the eugenicist. And all along, it's been eugenics, hidden behind other words. But it means we, a select few, want to have the perfect citizen, the perfect wife, the perfect husband, the Stepford wife, the man in the gray flannel suit. We want someone who will fit in, not argue, not dispute, not be contrary, and we're going to create it genetically. And yet we can't sell this to the public. There are too many people who are awake. They'll argue. What's that going to do to the rest of us? What are you going to do? Have soylent green homes where you can go in and watch a pleasant scene of a movie for 10 minutes of nature, and then you drink the drink, you die, and you turned into something else, like a cracker called soylent green? What about all the poor people? What about the people who are not going to be 6'6"? What about the people who won't have the high IQ to begin birth with? Then you have a real big divide. You think the divide now? And by the way, let's get over this idea that it's 1% versus 99%. It's about 30%. That's what it is, 30%. That's the reality. That's the real figure that disqualifies us from having a nation of equality. Inequality is about 70% that have little to nothing and 30% who have far more than what they need. And then of that 30%, 0.1% have as much as the rest of those, 29% combined. So which one of those do you think the genes are going to be meant for? So this is the story that tells where we're going, and I'm going to hold off the conclusion till the end so you'll see it. But listen to the names, the Carnegie Institute, and the University of Chicago, and MIT, and Harvard, and the Rockefeller Foundation, and the UN, and every single important power player and technocrat that becomes one stitch in this cloth of eugenics, of population control, of genetic control. And yet they'll always sell it with a good face. We want to reverse and prevent genetic inherited diseases. We want to prevent the genes that will cause a woman to have breast cancer. Of course, they're going to own your genes when you take the test. Are you aware of that? And that's right now as we speak. So that's going to be much of our program today and tomorrow and the next day till this series is finished. Hard-hitting? Yes. In-depth? Yes. But necessary because it's a message done with great insight by the scholar, journalist, James Corbett. We need to hear this. So that's our show. But as always, we like to start with something that we can all understand. Our health. Researchers from the University of Wisconsin evaluated whether one simple addition to the diet, one handful a day of dried cranberries, could positively influence the gut microbiome. As I said yesterday, given the emerging knowledge that many biological functions, including immunity and disease-fighting capabilities, depend on a healthy gut microbiome, the authors of the recently published study in the Journal of Integrated Biology tested whether dried cranberries could make a difference. Now get this, after just 2 weeks, with only 10 individuals, the differences were statistically substantial in that they showed that everybody's moving in the right direction because dried cranberries are beneficial, and that's important. They can impact the proteins and the bacteria in the gut and provide urinary protection. That's important. So get your cranberries. I don't suggest eating dried cranberries because most of the time they're going to be sweetened. Instead, I recommend 1 to 2 ounces of organic cranberry concentrate, not juice, concentrate. It's a little strong, but you can dilute it in some other juice, and that will help protect the microorganisms in your stomach and even the type of bacteria that you have in your gut, and that can protect you. So one more reason we should be taking something like a superfood, and it's cranberry concentrate. Rice University says that disaster or makes people, it's depression, less healthy. So we all know that if we are exposed to any type of major disaster or life stressor, such as a disaster, we can experience increase in inflammation. And inflammation is a major risk factor for heart disease and other negative health outcomes. And the findings have important implications for survivors of crisis situations. Just think of all the crisis that you're having emotionally in the people living in Northern California and now Southern California. By the way, now the fires are raging in San Diego area, and they're asking for major evacuation there. The whole state's on fire. And it's going, are you ready for this? Highest temperature in late October in the history of the state of California since records were kept. Triple digits, 104, 106 degrees. And that means everything is dry as a bone. That means a lightning strike or many other reasons for fires. If a power line goes down, it can cause a fire, which is one of the reasons they suspect that the Sonoma and the upper wine country had so many fires, because the storm that hit was so fierce that the winds alone were up to 60 miles an hour, and that blew down some poles, and that in turn caused the fires from the electrical lines on the ground. And those were old infrastructure. In fact, they actually had spent $60 million that was supposed to be used to upgrade the electrical grid, which is ancient throughout America, and they didn't. They put it back into profits. In any case, think of the people who were given under 5 minutes warning. 5 minutes. Now you're not prepared. It's in the night. You're asleep. You have someone banging on your door. Fire, get out. Get out where? Which way do I go? Do I go north? Do I go south? What do I take with me? And almost always people are in such a crisis emotionally. They don't know what's important. They haven't planned. And the community didn't plan. And the state didn't plan. And the federal government didn't plan. Now, they could have had large fire alarms, smoke alarms, that, like an air raid siren. You hear that, you know that there's a fire coming. You know you must move. If you have a list and you have that list posted in the house, and if you're prepared, and if you've done your homework, at least you'll be able to get the most important things or the things you value most out. If you have a trailer, which every home should have, no exceptions, then you can load up that trailer very quickly and at least save some things. But no one did any of that. No one got out with anything. Everything was burned to the ground. And a lot of people will not be covered because of insurance. Now, why aren't we talking about going down to Texas, down to the Gulf, south of Houston, Brownsville, going clear over Biloxi, New Orleans, clear around Louisiana, where that storm hit Category 4? I have not heard a single word in the papers about helping people suffering from post-disaster crisis. Now, what if you were already depressed for normal life reasons? You are functional, but you're still depressed. This can throw you right down the rabbit hole with your health, especially when insurance companies are notorious for not wanting to cover you for your full loss. In fact, right now I'm going to be suing my insurance company because I've been offered less than 15% of my loss. And I have the resources to fight them. What about people who don't? They're wiped out. They don't have the money to rebuild. They don't have the money to move. Now imagine dealing with that. Why are there no efforts to help people with the psychological, the emotional, the human reality of crisis? People come back from Afghanistan, from Iraq, from whatever theater of war they're in, and Africa. And they've either seen things that shock them, or they've done things that have now, on reflection, they should never have done. Before we put a person into battle, before we put them into conflict, we first have to do something that's essential. In effect, we have to give them a spiritual lobotomy. We have to desensitize them to that which is humane and spiritual. After all, you can't go into battle according to our military rules of conduct and show any remorse or respect or love for the other. If they're considered the enemy, we've already demonized them. We keep using words like axis of evil and Hitler so that whether it's one person or a nation, whether it's an individual on a motorcycle who may be a terrorist, or whether it's a wedding party where you clearly see children. These clowns, these cowards sitting in bunkers out in Las Vegas area in the desert, in air-conditioned rooms with 4 to 6 other people, all looking at large monitors, all hooked into Langley, all hooked into the National Security Agency, they're told, well, okay, we've got one suspect going into a building, but there's about 40 people around the building. Consider them enemy combatants. How do we know? Well, just anyone over the age of 12 is considered now an enemy combatant in every country of the world. How do I know their age? I'll guess. Well, they're wearing hats and hoodies and scarves. I have no way of knowing it. They're not going to take out their ID, hold it up to the sky, and figure that the drone is going to see that they're 10 years old. Should I push the button for the drones? If we can get our target, then these are just unfortunate friendly fire or unfortunate casualties, collateral damage. No. They're decapitated, blown to smithereens, human beings. Only when we're forced to admit, because someone has some video of it or there's independent verification, do we admit we've done it, and then we minimize it. And then we'll pay some small compensation, $800 to $2,000 per family. And then it's over and you go forward. In fact, this president has caused the death of more civilians in his hyper-aggressive drone attacks than Obama did in 8 years. And Obama had done more than anyone else before then. You see, now you come back and you see that. And one day you walk out of that booth thinking, wow, I just caused the death of 87 people, and there might have been one suspect that was the target, and all those other people had to die, and there were a lot of men, women, and children, and babies there. And everyone in Washington doesn't give a damn. The White House doesn't give a damn. No one in the Pentagon gives a damn. No one in the CIA has ever given a damn. No one at the National Security Agency gives a damn. No one in Homeland Security gives a damn. No one in any place in Washington, none of the military contractors to make the drones, they don't give a damn. The people that make the bombs, they don't give a damn. Do you think anyone in Washington gives a damn about anything except their own career? And you sure as hell know the Clintons don't give a damn about anything except what's important to them. So then you're realizing you're walking between this little artificial environment, air-conditioned environment in the middle of the desert. Boy, that takes courage, doesn't it? To your car on your way home, and maybe for a moment in time, there's just a breakthrough where the actual spiritual self says, friend, you just committed murder. It doesn't matter who justifies it or how it's rationalized. Killing those people will not end terrorism. It only contributes to it. Nothing we ever do is done right. We're incapable as a country of doing a damn thing right when it comes to dealing with people. We do everything wrong and then expect not to be challenged for our outcome. Wow. So now you come back to the United States. Does anybody apologize for building the homes in wetlands that are flooded? No. In grasslands that no human being should be living on. And you don't have to have an IQ above 60, which is about half the people in the legislature in California. And they know that. No. Everybody knows that you shouldn't be living in certain places. So when disaster strikes, do you say, you know, my fault. I took the money from the land developers. I took the money from the bankers. I took the money from these scumbag low-life degenerates called hedge fund managers. And even below them, if you think that's humanly possible, the equity partner, like the Mitt Romneys and Bain Capitals. Yeah, we're all at fault because we put money above life and health, ethics and morality. And someone then chirps up and says, what are you, fool? When was the last time anyone in Washington even said the word moral? You can't. Before you live or work in Washington, D.C. at any level, you first must have someone go into your brain and take that part of the brain, the frontal lobotomy, that is going to be done so you no longer have to think of moral, ethical, honorable, humane, caring, compassionate, or empathetic. Those are all erased. Now we're looking at efficient and promotions. That's the world we live in. We may not like it. That's the truth of it. So, they're saying, gee whiz, when we're exposed to disasters, it really impacts us. Yes, it does. Now, when was the last time anyone apologized for participating or contributing to any of the disasters we have? Name me one. Global warming. The Koch brothers, the major industries, the coal industry, the hydrofracking industry. When you're eating meat, anyone eating a hamburger, hot dog, cheeseburger, they apologizing for contributing to global warming, which then causes the weather to increase, which then causes the intensity of the hurricane to increase, that causes the ground to dry, that causes the drought to precipitate, and then the fires come. No. We are clueless about how we individually and collectively contribute to disasters. And then on top of that, we're told, oh yeah, and if you got depression, it's going to make your health worse. Well, gee whiz, unless I miss something, you don't have to have a disaster to have bad health. We have a lot of other things we're doing in spite of disasters and in spite of depression to contribute to poor health. Maybe this is just one of those wake-up calls. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Oh, I'd like to welcome you. This program takes on serious issues, and we do not swim in shallow water. I don't teach at the level that people may be at. I teach at the level they're going to have to get up and learn some lessons so we're stopped being propagandized by the left, by the sellouts of the liberal corporate and neocon communities, by the right, and the conservative sellout neocon communities. This is about looking at the world for what it is, seeing it for what it is, so we can then get out of harm's way. We individually can make positive choices. We can choose not to line up like the idiots out in Wisconsin saying, yeah, put one of those chips in my hand. I want to be chipped. Yeah, fool, and what exactly is in that chip? Do you have any idea what kind of information, how many nanobytes of information they can get from you? What if in that chip was the ability at the National Security Agency to start your car and not be able to turn off the ignition, not be able to put on the brakes, hear every conversation you have, be able to monitor all your body organs? What if a person could, through genetic engineering, control your heart rate, your blood pressure, your blood sugar, and didn't tell you? What if we got to a place where we had a cashless society, which was where we're going, and you could only buy things because you could just scan your hand and it would be like a credit card or debit card? But now, everything about you is on that. Everywhere you went, every conversation you had, everything you did, they can monitor. That's where we're at right now, not the future. That's absolutely right now. And how many Americans are going to line up to be just one more human guinea pig? A lot of people, more than you could imagine. Not everyone, absolutely not everyone. But I'm trying to give those who would not line up, would not give away their rights, an opportunity to see what's behind all this. By the way, I'm going to play that in just a second, part three. But you won't want to miss tonight's Progressive Commentary Hour. Wow. It's going to be one of those shows where we got some real heavyweights on. And we're going to talk about localization, the localized movements to shift global and corporate power back to we the people and local communities. And Charles Eisenstein is on, one of the best scholars in America today. And he's an expert on human culture and identity. And he also deals with spiritual challenges of coping with the society and world in chaos. And he will be joined on the 7 o'clock show by Helena Norberg Hodge. She's well known. She's just one of the greatest minds on the planet. She's an activist, and she's a pioneer in global localization movements. And in fact, the Earth Journal included Helena among the 10 leading environmentalists worldwide. And so the two of them together, and she was studying with Noam Chomsky at MIT back in 1975. So, and she worked with the Ladakh tribes, which are known as Little Tibet in the Western Indian Himalayas. So we're going to learn a lot about how we can get off the grid, get away from their conditioning indoctrination, get away from the neoliberal agenda, get away from the current body politic, and become more self-actualized, working with local small communities. It'll be a wonderful program. Tell people about it 7 o'clock tonight. Now, here's part three of who's taking over the world, how they're doing it, and how they've been doing it all along. It names the names, gives the institution every single statement you're hearing is completely documented. It's historical fact. No conspiracy stuff here. Reality.
First Earth Summit ever held, representatives from 166 countries, 130 heads of state, and 15,000 non-governmental organizations came together with the hopes of deciding specific agreements that would balance environmental preservation with economic needs.
And my gratitude to Secretary General Maurice Strong for his tireless work in bringing this Earth Summit together. This is truly an historic gathering. There are those who say that economic growth and environmental protection cannot be compatible.
The world is our garden, and together we must cultivate it. This week at Rio, we have made a start. Beyond Rio, we must continue to carry it through.
We cannot be complacent unless the agreements reached here are accompanied by real commitments to significant change. Change, of course, indeed, for the human species. In my view, Your Excellencies, we simply are headed for a moment in the 21st century where the condition of our species may become terminal.
As useful as the Fourth World Wilderness Congress had been in advancing the agenda of Maurice Strong and the oligarchs, that was only setting the stage for the Earth Summit in Rio. At the Earth Summit, Edmund de Rothschild got his World Conservation Bank. Dubbed the Global Environment Facility and launched at the summit itself, it serves as the funding mechanism for five different UN conventions and provides billions of dollars worth of financing to environmental and development projects around the world. Its 18 implementing partners include the Rockefeller-funded Food and Agricultural Organization, the Huxley-founded International Union for the Conservation of Nature, the Maurice Strong-created United Nations Environment Program, and the Prince Bernard, Prince Philip, Godfrey Rockefeller-founded World Wildlife Fund. One of the Global Environment Facility's specialties are debt for nature swaps, where third world countries are given debt relief in return for opening their land up for environmental development projects. The projects come with transaction costs of up to 5%, paid to the contractors who manage and direct the investments, not the locals, who, like the Aborigines of Palawan Island, are kicked off their land and effectively wiped off the face of the map. The Earth Summit also gave rise to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, the body to which the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change delivers its reports. Generally thought to be neutral, non-governmental bodies relying only on science and evidence, the UNFCCC and the IPCC are handcuffed by the terms that Strong set out for them to deliver only one conclusion: that humanity is to blame for climate change.
When they set up the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, Maurice Strong, who we should talk a lot about, he wrote the terms of reference. And the first term of reference was the definition of climate change. And he limited it deliberately to only human causes of climate change. And, of course, that effectively eliminated all the natural causes, natural variability, which is why you see them not looking at things like the sun, and a whole bunch of other issues. And, of course, he then limited it even further in another term of reference that he set it up into three working groups. There was the technical group, working group one, which was wrote the science report. And that was 600 of the 2,500 people. The other 1,900 were in working groups two and three. Now, they were inconsequential because they had to accept the findings of working group one, which were already limited by their terms of reference. So whatever their finding was, working groups two and three then said, okay, you telling us it's going to warm, we accept that as fact. We now look at the implications of that. And that's where you hear all these stories about, oh, the ice is going to melt, the sea level is going to rise. So really, the majority of the report by 1,900 scientists is accepting without question the finding of the first group. Now, Strong, it really restricted it even more because they came out and said, look, this report is not to be used for policy. But then they set up the summary for policymakers, the absolute contradiction of that. And the summary for policymakers is written by a completely separate group. And then they write it independent of the science report. The science report's finished and set aside. The summary for policymakers is written and given out to the media. The rules, the terms of reference that Strong wrote said that the summary for policymakers goes back to the science report people and says, make sure your science report agrees with what we've put in the summary.
Another product of the Earth Summit in Rio was the Earth Charter, a quasi-religious document that Mikhail Gorbachev, who helped draft the text along with Maurice Strong, referred to as a replacement for the Ten Commandments, and which sought to usher in an era of Gaia worship and global responsibility, declaring that fundamental changes are needed in our values, institutions, and ways of living. The document then counsels that we must create a world of shared responsibility to the Earth community, before concluding, "In order to build a sustainable global community, the nations of the world must renew their commitment to the United Nations, fulfill their obligations under existing international agreements, and support the implementation of Earth Charter principles with an international, legally binding instrument on environment and development."
Well, the Earth Charter was one of the byproducts, ultimately, of the first Earth Summit. I published the Earth Charter in my in the appendix of my book, Technocracy Rising, the Trojan Horse of Global Transformation, just so people could see this with their own eyes, what it says. It was a document that was like a compact with the world. It was a very religious, humanistic document that tried to unify the world into a single concept of globalization. And it was a very defined document that was signed off. The history goes back before that, but it was finally signed off by I don't know how many, just almost all the nations at the United Nations. And the primary author of the Earth Charter was Stephen Rockefeller. And so the Rockefellers understood early on that, no, it's not just the economic system, and it's not just necessarily the political control system. We also have to factor in a religious belief that we can use to get people to believe what we're doing is for their good.
What the oligarchs had been working toward for decades, and what they achieved in Rio in 1992, was the completion of the transformation of the eugenics philosophy, from talk of sterilization of the feeble-minded, to a popular understanding of humanity as a cancer that must be removed for the Earth to live. Now, the duty was to reduce carbon footprints and reduce the population in the name of saving the planet. Wrapped in this new vocabulary, and coming with a trendy, pervasive, and well-funded advertising campaign, the end result sounded remarkably similar to the eugenics of old.
A new study from Lund University in Sweden says the single best way to cut your carbon footprint, assuming you want to, is simply to refuse to reproduce. Deleting some humans from existence, they say, saves far more carbon than, I don't know, being vegetarian, riding a bike to work, not boarding an airplane.
There is a study that says, well, actually, if we reduced global fertility by half a child per woman, okay, that you could maybe do that. It would go a long way, but it would reduce like a big chunk, a fifth to a quarter of all carbon emissions needed to avoid that tipping point.
So should we have policies that penalize people for having extra kids in the developed world?
So I do think that we should at least consider it.
Well, at least consider it is like do it.
In the push to reduce global warming, children, according to some, are the new culprits. A think tank in the UK says too many kids are what's making the planet worse, saying large families, anything over two children really, should be frowned upon as an environmental no-no.
And, without the public even noticing it, the oligarchs were able to wrap themselves in this new flag to appear not as the billionaire scions of the oil industry who made their vast fortunes by plundering the earth and monopolizing its wealth, but as crusading environmentalists who are going to save the planet from the cannon fodder that unfortunately populates the earth.
The negative impact of population growth on all of our planetary ecosystems is becoming appallingly evident.
So we have been members of the IPCC, we have authored many of their papers, we have peer-reviewed all their papers. So we have been engaged in the understanding of the evolution of our understanding of climate change for decades.
At Saudi Aramco, we strive to continually reduce the environmental impact of our operations, from oil well to consumer, and our support for the Oil and Gas Climate Initiative that strives to be a catalyst for practical action on climate change through collaboration on technology and best practices.
We have a common reason. We care about environment. We think that together we can do better. We have the competencies, we have the strength, we have the tools to do good things in this field.
Technology that will be developed through this investment fund of $1 billion will help us in the long term to reduce emissions.
We want to build an ecosystem of innovation on this issue, working together.
Putting our force together, we can bring pragmatic and concrete solutions.
And even today, the masses, outraged over the carnage that big oil has wrought, are content to have that outrage directed by the very oligarchs they seek to oppose. The same oligarchs who are quietly funding and supporting their environmental movement from behind the scenes, and even leading it from the front. The Rockefeller family made headlines by divesting from oil completely in 2016.
The Rockefellers, heir to an oil fortune that made the family name a symbol of American wealth, believe they're doing their namesake proud by getting out of oil. Fund director Stephen Hines spoke reverently of oil tycoon John D. Rockefeller in a statement. "We are quite convinced that if he were alive today, as an astute businessman looking out to the future, he would be moving out of fossil fuels and investing in clean, renewable energy."
David Rothschild is one of the photogenic leading lights of the environmental movement. Dubbed Plastic Jesus for his publicity stunts and photo opportunities masquerading as a concerned environmentalist, David Rothschild, a scion of the billionaire banking family that added to its fortune with its Azerbaijani oil field holdings and still invests in oil through ventures like Genie Energy, now spends his time lecturing the public about how their lifestyles are killing the polar bears.
We have to start spending money, fast on the solutions that we have in hand to try and help these countries which are already seeing the effects of climate change today and seeing the effects of our consumption, basically.
Prince Charles is outspoken on the subject of global warming, warning his loyal subjects that unless they tighten their belts and live more humble lives, they will bring about the end of the world.
Ladies and gentlemen, the battle against climate change is surely the most defining and pivotal challenge of our times. We cannot ignore the symptoms and should act now to restore the health of the planet before it is too late. This, of course, will require an unprecedented transformation of our communities, science, societies, and lifestyles, all predicated on the move to a low-carbon and circular economy.
The groundwork has been laid for what these oligarchs call the post-carbon era. It is no longer about oil. It never was. It is about control.
Now, to this complete cycle for the world, to give you a time scale on that, bear in mind that started in 1857. And so here's where we were about 3 or 4 years ago. This was proved reserves in here, which would add up to about here. And the estimated peak would occur about 1995, and we go into the decline. That middle 80% again is a spread from the 60s, the late 60s, up till a little over 20, beyond 2020, or it's computed out here about 56 years. Mm-hmm. That assumes an orderly evolution. That says that a child born, say, within the last 10 years will probably see the world consume most of its oil if he lives a normal life.
In his lifetime.
Today, Marion King Hubbert is best known as the Shell Oil researcher who gained notoriety in the 1950s for predicting that the U.S. would achieve its peak production of petroleum by 1970 and that almost all of the planet's oil supplies would be exhausted by 2020. This peak oil theory, still sometimes referred to as Hubbert's peak, was, like everything else generated by big oil, a conveniently crafted lie, designed to habituate the market to artificial scarcity and thus keep oil prices high. Hubbert's prediction was not based on any empirical data from any oil field, but instead relied on Hubbert's incorrect guesses about remaining oil reserves and employed a heuristic tool to model production. as Hubbard's protege and colleague at Shell Oil, Kenneth DeFays, conceded years later. The numerical methods that Hubbard used to make his prediction are not crystal clear. Today, 44 years later, my guess is that Hubbard, like everyone else, reached his conclusion first and then searched for raw data and methods to support his conclusion. Shortly before his death in 1989, Hubbard himself admitted that when he showed his peak oil paper to Shell's managing director before presenting it to his colleagues, the director had told him not to go overboard with his estimates of oil reserves, pointing specifically to L.G. Weeks, a rival geophysicist who had estimated reserves to be much higher, and thus the impending threat of undersupply and the need for high oil prices to be much weaker. But although today Hubbard is remembered almost exclusively for his peak oil thesis, he was in fact involved in a much larger, lifelong project, helping to codify and incorporate a movement that, much like eugenics, was wildly popular nearly a century ago, fell out of favor in polite society, and yet continues today under other names. That movement was called technocracy.
Hello, I'm Arvid Peterson, and this is the first of a two-part presentation on technocracy, an alternative social system. These programs are not intended to entertain or amuse you, nor are they meant to scare you. We are making a new approach. It is not political, financial, philosophical, legal, religious, or moral. It is a technological approach. Technocracy is the scientific answer to America's social problems. And technocracy is a new design for social operation that is based upon science. It is the vehicle by which we can move into a new era for better living.
Technocracy billed itself as a social movement, a philosophy, a scientific solution to political and economic problems, and a new way of ordering the world. But at base, it is an idea for a new international economic order, one to be designed and managed down to the most minute detail by a select few, the technocrats.
Technocracy was defined very succinctly in 1938 by their own publication, the Technocrat magazine. And they call it a system of scientific engineering of, you know, society. They saw themselves as a merger between hard science and social science, which really is an oxymoron. Social science is not really a science, in my opinion. But they really believed that. So they believed that they could take their scientific method that they used in the hard sciences and apply it to society. They also believed that they alone were the only ones that could run society correctly as a result of technology having come in and changed the fabric of society. They hated politicians. They hated the establishment, the organization of society the way it was, because it was not efficient. It was not, a conservation-based, if you will, to conserve resources. And so they just kind of took it upon themselves to define an economic model that would replace capitalism and free enterprise. And that's exactly what it was, replacement economic system.
Drawing on Henri Saint-Simon's call for a scientifically organized socialist system, the positivism and secular humanism of Auguste Comte, and the principles of scientific management propounded by Frederick Taylor, the technocratic movement emerged from the same environment of progressivism, positivism, and social Darwinism that birthed eugenics. Just as the eugenicists believed the human race could be improved through selective breeding controlled and administered by a small group of scientists and their billionaire backers, so too did the technocrats believe that they could improve the social and economic conditions of humanity by controlling and administering society. And, happily enough for the oligarchs, the technocrats would improve the world by replacing money with energy certificates. Led by the eccentric revolutionary economist and sociologist Thorstein Veblen, the technocratic movement that formed around Veblen's New School for Social Research and Technical Alliance attracted both engineers and serious researchers like King Hubbard and Buckminster Fuller, and fellow eccentrics like Howard Scott. Scott, a mysterious man of uncertain background, established himself in New York City at the end of World War I and came to be seen as a bohemian engineer. In 1920, he went to work for the Wobblies as a research director, and the following year he founded the Technical Alliance, a group of engineers and scientists centered around Columbia University, who, as a forerunner to the technocracy movement, advocated for a society run by scientists and engineers. In 1932, the charismatic and well-spoken Scott managed to attach himself to Walter Raudenstrauch, a professor at Columbia and the founder of the university's Department of Industrial Engineering. With a common interest in technocracy, the two became friends and allies. It was through Raudenstrauch that Scott was able to approach the president of Columbia, Nicholas Murray Butler, for permission to use the university's facilities. Butler, always on the lookout for the cutting edge of progressivism, was swayed by the technocratic ideas, and soon Scott's Committee on Technocracy was operating out of the basement of Hamilton Hall. When Butler let word slip about the next big idea being cooked up in the basement of his university, technocracy became a sensation. It was lauded in the press. Scott became a sought-after speaker, and there was even a dance named after the movement. It was at Columbia that Scott met King Hubbert, and the two, an unlikely pair of serious-minded researcher and eccentric revolutionary, immediately...
All right, now we're going to put it on hold here because I'm going to open it up for you for talk back. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. We'll continue with part four tomorrow. Look where this is going. Look at all the opportunities we have today with legitimate healing of the human body, the environment, with biodiversity farming, with hydroponics, with reconstituting soil, green manure in the wintertime, meaning you put down a green crop. Think of all the ways that we have could ask people to save their money, to stop overconsuming. Every time there's a movement that can bring us back to health and wholeness, there are the technocrats, the very people he's talking about, coming forward and saying, no, 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 science knows best. So it's science that tells you that you have to send a check and a checkup to cure cancer in 45 years of a statistical significance. The only improvements in cancer survival are based upon people making preventative lifestyle choices. They're given no credit. If you were to take vitamin C at 500 milligrams a day and you did not come down with a cold at the end of the year, no one would suggest that it was the vitamin C that prevented the cold. But if everyone in this audience took a vaccine for flu and you did not come down with the flu, the scientific community would give 100% of the credit for you not getting the flu vaccine. It would suddenly be their statistical outcome. Oh, 99% of the people didn't get the flu this year because they got the flu vaccine. That's the power when science becomes a religion and everyone prays at that altar because there's reward for compliance, punishment, heresy for challenge. In every part of life, genetic engineering, science says it's safe. Smoking, it's safe. Drinking, it's safe. It actually is good for your heart. All of those are lies. Real science shows they're lies, but the body politic of science shows it's on their side. So we are always looking at science as the final arbiter of everything that's true. And so you say global warming that has been caused substantially by the Industrial Revolution and our own input, we're told, well, that's still up for debate. There's unanswered questions. There's no, it's not unanswered. Science for hire will keep us at that level. Additionally, we have this to deal with. They're talking about how too many people in a family are causing us problems. Yeah. Whose family are you referring to? Look at the people in poor countries. They consume the least amount of energy. They do the least amount of destruction to the environment. They have the least amount of animal proteins. They use the least amount of carbon products. So the reality is, the more affluent a person is, the richer a person is. A Leonardo DiCaprio, who is one of these faux ecologists, who goes from Cannes Film Festival on a private jet to pick up a Riverkeepers Award and fly back on a private jet, that's considered environmentally conscious. No, that's stupidity. That is the kind of lifestyle that eats an enormous amount of the energy, and yet they're never asked to curtail. If you're rich and powerful, you want to build a 500-foot yacht like David Geffen, that's considered wonderful you. But then no one asked, how much does that cost the environment? And we look always at those who do the least damage, the least harm, consume the least, and blame them for the excesses of the majority. And we never curtail the consumption of food, of clothing, of cars, of building houses, whatever it can do to destroy the environment. We never stop that. Now we want to eugenically control the population at the other end. That's what we're faced with. We're up to near of our end of our program, but let's say hello to Ronald from Long Island. Hi, Ronald. Your turn. You're on the air.
Thank you. Certainly, we should reduce our consumption as much as possible. There's no question about that. But also, population reduction generally seems like a very, very good idea to help reduce the stress on the planet. It's just so obvious.
So that's not the issue. But go take it one step further, Ronald. It's not the question, do we have unlimited resources on this finite planet? We'd have to 1.5 Earths to supply the resources we need based upon how they're currently distributed. We have enough food. In fact, we have too much food. We actually have it go waste. But it's how we distribute the food. Who gets the food? How much does it cost? Who profits from it? And if you're going to say we should have an equal amount of population control, should that not also be true for the President of the United States' family or a Wall Street baron or anyone else? Or are you going to offer that it is only for those who are the least powerful who should make the greatest sacrifice? And should you also not give those people an opportunity to participate in some form of contraceptive control rather than eugenically deciding that you're going to give them vaccines that will automatically sterilize them?
We should all do what we can, no matter what sector of society, to help reduce population. It certainly shouldn't be limited to the poor. It should be everyone.
Right now it is. You never hear a wealthy person being asked, you're consuming too much, your child will be a burden upon the future based upon what that child would consume, so do not have that child. See how that goes down. Mm-hmm. But I appreciate your input, Ronald. Thank you for calling in. We will have more discussion and a full hour debate on what to do about population, and you'll have your opportunity to share points of view. I want to thank you all for listening. And by the way, if anyone knows where Lynn Gannett is, she's an outstanding researcher. Need to speak with Lynn about some important work she did. She did a lot of AIDS research. She was on the first AZT study trial. Let me know, and if you could let me know where she's at. I've got a phone number and address. I'd like to know Lynn Gannett. Listen tonight at 7 o'clock, Progressive Commentary Hour. A lot of heavy thoughts are going to be wafting through the air. Have a nice day, everyone.